Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, November 14th through Saturday, the 16th, feature guest conductor Marek Janowski and piano soloist Francesco Piemontese. The program includes The Ruler of the Spirits Overture by Carl Maria von Weber, Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 2, and after intermission, Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 3. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on the Liszt Piano Concerto No. 2, a work lasting about 22 minutes. Liszt is music's misunderstood genius. The greatest pianist of his time, he often has been caricatured as a mad, intemperate virtuoso and as a shameless and tawdry showman. Early in his career, he tried, with uncanny success, to emulate both the theatrical extravagance and technical brilliance of the superstar violinist Paganini. But when Robert Schumann heard Liszt play, he was struck most of all by the young musician's tenderness and boldness of emotion. Clara Schumann, an important pianist herself, told her husband, "When I heard Liszt for the first time in Vienna, I just couldn't control myself. I sobbed freely with emotion." Although his popularity as a pianist was nearly unrivaled in the 19th century, his ultimate importance to music history is as a serious, boldly original, and even revolutionary composer. By the time he gave up his public career in 1847, a month before his 36th birthday, to devote time to composition and conducting, Liszt had not only written dozens of solo display pieces to take on the road, but he had also begun experimenting with large-scale works for piano and orchestra. His father, Adam, remembered two piano concertos from the 1820s. They have not survived. There's a grand Fantaisie symphonique on themes by Berlioz and a Fantasia on Beethoven's Ruins of Athens, both dating from the 1830s. During that decade, Liszt also sketched the two familiar piano concertos and drafted a third he ultimately set aside. The autograph was discovered in 1988. Janina Filkowska gave the world premiere with Kenneth Jean conducting the Chicago Symphony on May 3, 1990. Liszt never met Franz Schubert, the composer whose influence on his concept of instrumental form was the most profound, even though they lived near each other in Vienna for more than a year. Liszt admired Schubert's music throughout his life, and he made piano transcriptions of many of the great songs so that he could play them in recital. Of all of Schubert's compositions, it was The Wanderer Fantasy, a large and demanding work for solo piano that he loved most, and it was practically the only one of Schubert's piano pieces that he played publicly. In the early 1850s, after he had retired from the concert stage, Liszt arranged Schubert's Wanderer Fantasy for piano and orchestra, and also for two pianos. Liszt was attracted not only by the fantasy's wild virtuosity, so unexpected from Schubert, normally the most self-effacing of composers, but also by its extraordinary form, four movements linked in a continuous structure and further unified by a single theme. Liszt was decades ahead of his time in his appreciation of Schubert, and the music he ultimately wrote in the spirit of the Wanderer Fantasy, bold experiments with questions of organization and formal structure, are the works of a pioneer, not a mimic. Liszt's masterpiece in this quest is his own single greatest work for solo piano, the Sonata in B minor. Both piano concertos are indebted to Schubert's idea of individual movements bound together as one, though it is the first that more closely follows the path of the Wanderer Fantasy. Both benefit from Liszt's evolving concept of an entire full-length piece that works like a single movement in sonata form, with material introduced, developed, and later recapitulated. And both demonstrate Liszt's extraordinary skill at thematic camouflage and transformation, the ability to manufacture themes of remarkably diverse character from the same melody. Liszt originally called his second piano concerto a concerto symphonique, after the works of the same name by Henri Lithoff, a pianist and composer who normally followed Liszt's lead in artistic matters, just as his name now follows Liszt in music dictionaries. Liszt was interested in Lithoff's concertos because they explored unconventional designs for large pieces combining piano and orchestra. But Liszt ultimately dispensed with the borrowed title, recognizing that, whatever its hybrid qualities, his score was more concerto than symphony. He and Lithoff were longtime friends, and Liszt dedicated his first piano concerto to him. Today, we frequently encountered Lithoff's name only through the publishing house he acquired with his second marriage. The second concerto continues to explore the ideas of joining sections and thematic variation found in the first, although it's more subtle in its melodic sleight of hand and freer and more mysterious in its progression of linked movements. It's also less overtly virtuosic, as if Liszt had taken to heart Lithoff's idea of solo and orchestra as two closely integrated entities. Where Liszt introduced the soloist in a dazzling display of octaves and filigree in the first concerto, here the piano slips in with gentle arpeggios between the quiet wind music that opens the work. It's remarkable how often in this concerto the piano appears to accompany the orchestra. Soon, the piano asserts itself, and eventually there is even a cadenza, though it's short and to the point, which is to introduce a new section. Throughout this concerto, the pianist often helps Liszt move from section to section, from the gentle nocturne to a dazzling scherzo and the martial finale, without breaking the continuity. The success of Liszt's continuous form depends on his command of thematic metamorphosis. It's a technique he learned not only from Schubert, but also from the finale of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, where the Ode to Joy becomes a Turkish march with cymbals and drums, and from the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, with its superb and classic Idée Fixe, eventually converted into one of the most grotesque melodies in music. Better than either of these composers, Liszt understood the full potential of the concept, disguise so complete as to be unrecognizable, and the A major concerto is one of his most masterful demonstrations. The lyrical opening melody, to take the most obvious example, arrives at the finale dressed for a great march, a makeover that's hardly undetectable but complete nonetheless, with its pace, character, time signature, key, and dynamics all dramatically altered. Although this brilliant and noisy march often has been criticized as a vulgar betrayal of Liszt's original theme, it succeeds admirably, both as a rousing finale and as a demonstration of the art of camouflage. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Franz Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 2. And now on to the Bruckner Third Symphony, a work lasting about 54 minutes. At the end of the first performance of Bruckner's Third Symphony, there were just 25 people left in the audience. One of them was a 17-year-old composer named Gustav Mahler, who recognized this as music of true genius and who would later face a similar fate himself. The performance was a disaster from the moment Bruckner stepped on stage to conduct. Each movement was greeted with hissing and catcalls. The audience dwindled steadily throughout the evening. With the last note, the orchestra members walked off stage, leaving Bruckner alone to face the few survivors. It was the worst night of his career. This score has the most troubled history of any Bruckner symphony. Bruckner began his D minor symphony, the one he numbered his third, although there were at least four that preceded it, in 1873 at the age of 49, and he didn't stop fussing with it for another 16 years. Bruckner was middle-aged before he introduced any of his symphonies that would make him so controversial and later so famous. In 1873, Bruckner was known in Vienna as an organist of considerable skill and as a composer of grandiose masses. His first two symphonies had been denounced as wild and unplayable by the members of the Vienna Philharmonic, and in 1875, at a trial run-through, they would say the same of the third. In September 1873, Bruckner wrote a letter to Richard Wagner, a composer as influential as he himself was ignored, hoping for a meeting and for advice and encouragement. When Wagner didn't reply, Bruckner went to Bayreuth and appeared unannounced at Wagner's door. a move of uncharacteristic decisiveness. It's hard to know what the great Wagner thought of the intruder or his music, because the principal accounts of that Bayreuth meeting come from Bruckner, a teetotaler who drank so much beer that day that his memory can scarcely be trusted, and the sculptor Gustav Keitz, who was so busy on a bust of Wagner's wife Cosima that he thought the two men talked mostly of Beethoven. Years later, Bruckner reconstructed the day. First, he asked Wagner to look at his Second Symphony. Wagner thought it was very nice, which Bruckner rightly reckoned to mean boring. Then, Bruckner offered his Third Symphony in D minor, which wasn't quite finished. Wagner seemed more interested and asked Bruckner to leave the score. He would look it over after lunch. Bruckner was so excited that he asked Wagner if he might dedicate the symphony to him. Wagner asked him to come back at 5 o'clock. What transpired at 5 o'clock was a lot of friendly talk and even more drinking, and when Wagner awoke the next morning, he could only remember that Wagner had liked much of what he saw, but he couldn't recall which symphony, in the end, Wagner liked best. With the odd combination of naivete and clumsiness that would always define Bruckner's social graces, he dropped Wagner a note. Symphony in D minor, where the trumpet begins the theme? At the bottom of the page, Wagner scribbled, "Yes, yes, kindest regards." Bruckner first heard Wagner's music a decade earlier. He would always remember February 13, 1863, the first Linz performance of Tannhäuser as the opening of a new and decisive chapter in his own work. Without the stimulus of Wagner's powerful and revolutionary music, Bruckner would surely never have become the composer we know. "I didn't dare before," he said later in 1863, when others commented that his own music had suddenly taken off in bold new directions. When Bruckner attended the premiere of Tristan and Isolde in Munich in 1865, he met Wagner but didn't have the nerve to show him his First Symphony. But now, 8 years later, Bruckner found himself in Wagner's house, Wahnfried, talking music. And so, with Wagner's blessing, Bruckner's Third Symphony, the one with the trumpet theme, came to be known as the Wagner Symphony. In the end, that did Bruckner more damage than good, because he had unwittingly entered the heated, highly political Wagner-Brahms debate. In the words of Erwin Dornberg, an early biographer, Bruckner strayed into the battlefield and became the only casualty. Bruckner was immediately branded a Wagnerian, earning the suspicion of much of the music-loving public and the fatal hostility of Eduard Hanslick, a critic of an almost unimaginable influence. "Whom I wish to destroy shall be destroyed," Hanslick said in all seriousness. Wagner was in the audience the night of December 16, 1877, and he must have enjoyed filing this report: "A vision of how Beethoven's Ninth befriends Wagner's Walküre and finds itself under her horse's hooves." That fraction of the audience which remained to the end consoled the composer for the flight of the rest. Bruckner was now bad press and bad box office, and it was 4 years before anyone would consider playing his music again. The experience devastated Bruckner, a man of painful insecurity whose only real error, aside from composing music that was ahead of its time, was to write on the title page of his Third Symphony the words "Meister Richard Wagner" in tiefster Ehrfurcht, in deepest awe. By 1877, Bruckner had even cleaned his score of the direct musical quotations from Wagner's Tristan and Die Meistersinger, innocent tributes that might have ruined his career as a symphonist for good. Despite the 1877 fiasco, Theodor Rettig published the score the following year. It was the first Bruckner symphony to come out in print, as well as a piano duet version made by Gustav Mahler and Rudolf Kirshanovsky. The Third Symphony did not catch on. Nearly a decade later, when Bruckner's Eighth Symphony was the target of new abuse and Bruckner fell into the deepest depression of his life, he began an almost manic revision of several of his earlier symphonies. The third suffered the most. Since Bruckner couldn't trust his own judgment, he made an even greater error in following that of his student and disciple Franz Schalk. Together, they cut several substantial passages and reorchestrated others. Schalk composed new transitions, not always with Bruckner's knowledge or consent. When the symphony was performed in the final, though hardly definitive, version in 1890, the applause was warmer, but the score had been through so many changes that even the composer wasn't certain that it was any better. The 1889 version is the one conductors often prefer today, and it is the one that Marek Janowski conducts at these performances. The opening of this symphony suggests why Gustav Keitz, who eavesdropped on the 1873 meeting between Bruckner and Wagner, remembers hearing talk of Beethoven. Bruckner begins in D minor, like his and Wagner's favorite Beethoven symphony, the Ninth, and in the murky haze from which the music slowly emerges. The same is true of Wagner's Die Walküre. It's an idea Bruckner liked so much that 5 of his 9 numbered symphonies open this way. Here, the trumpet theme Wagner admired steers the music toward its first climax. It's a big movement, drawn on a large canvas, moving sometimes directly from fierce unison outbursts to quiet, hymn-like chords, and ranging from brilliant, noisy passages to sudden silence. Bruckner's large-scale movements don't unfold like other music. This one is volatile and unpredictable, a quirky mixture of rugged and delicate, of motion and stasis. It's often said that the Third Symphony is the first to reveal Bruckner's individual musical voice, and this movement offers most of his hallmarks. The slow movement is broad and noble at the beginning, warmer and more chromatic as it progresses. It's interrupted periodically by a quiet benediction in the strings, the cadences of a Mozart mass still echoing in a great cathedral. After the climax, the music dies away with chords Bruckner found in the magic sleep music of Wagner's Die Walküre. The scherzo begins quietly, rages furiously, and dissolves into country dancing in the trio. The finale is complex and provocative, an oddly successful juxtaposition of unlikely materials. It begins, like so much of Bruckner's music, with brass fanfares. Next, a benign polka melody in the strings dances over a solemn chorale. Bruckner later recalled strolling on the Schottenring in Vienna one evening and hearing party music blasting from a house not far from where the body of the cathedral architect Schmidt lay in state. Bruckner couldn't find the words to explain how it affected him and why it seemed to encapsulate life, but his music speaks eloquently. The trumpet theme from the first movement returns at the end in a blaze of brass, a reminder that for Bruckner, this was Wagner's symphony as much as his own. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Bruckner Third Symphony. I'm Richard Caparella. Thanks for listening.